You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the holiday 2017-2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. And this holiday issue features on the cover the stars of the Marvel franchise, along with this quote from Charles Dickens, "The world is, in all great essentials, better, gentler, more forbearing, and more hopeful as it rolls." Here are some of the contributors to the holiday issue. Chris Garrett. Early in her career, Chris Garrett was managing editor of Condé Nast, Tatler magazine in London, and twice came to New York as a guest editor at Vanity Fair. After moving to New York, she became a talent scout for Condé Nast, but was not long in the role when one morning in 1992, she was asked to meet with Condé Nast chairman S.I. Newhouse Jr., who had just hired Graydon Carter to be editor of Vanity Fair. Cy was hugely knowledgeable about movies, and laughing, he observed, "This is like the scene from The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, where Cyril Cusack tells Richard Burton that it is time for him to come in from the cold." He added, "We need you on Vanity Fair. Graydon should have someone who knows the staff and the culture." "How long? A year? Two?" Garrett asked. "We'll see," he said. 25 years later, Garrett, happily, is still at Vanity Fair as managing editor. Widely admired for her consummate skills in management, strategy, and diplomacy, she enables and ennobles every aspect of the magazine. "Vanity Fair would be an annual were it not for Chris," says Graydon Carter. "She's one of those people who make the impossible look effortless. Furthermore, she can talk you out of a bad idea with such grace and elegance that you don't even know you have been talked out of it. Without her, I would have been booted out at the end of year one." Jason Bell. Photographer Jason Bell shot the constellation of Marvel superheroes for this issue's four covers and for Master of the Universe. To commemorate 10 industry-changing years and 17 films of Marvel Studios, the actors gathered in not just their heroes' respective regalia, but also their headspaces. Every actor was very mindful of what their character would or wouldn't do. "The rules of their world, as it were," says Bell, who has contributed to a book about Aston Martin out this summer. Sarah Ellison. "It's hard not to feel like she's trapped in that White House," says special correspondent Sarah Ellison of First Lady Melania Trump, whose purported activism against cyberbullying, perhaps her husband's most inveterate practice, hasn't appreciably taken off. In FLOTUS position, Ellison uncovers the possibility of Melania as a fully realized First Lady in the near future. She has more influence than she seems to understand. Sharon Sue. "Graydon always encouraged me, and I wouldn't be the photographer I am today without that," says Sharon Sue, who, for Hall of Fame, shot the New York Times reporters whose exposés helped oust Harvey Weinstein and Bill O'Reilly. "When I was 18, a professor harassed me in the darkroom. He tried, but I got away. After that, I got C's," Sue says. "I connected with what these people are working tirelessly to uncover." Joanna Robinson, in Master of the Universe, Joanna Robinson unpacks how Marvel Studios, with 17 films, including Iron Man, The Avengers, and Guardians of the Galaxy, has revolutionized the world of movies. By expanding the genre and finding new talent, Marvel hits so many different interests, Robinson says, of the studio that Disney acquired in 2009. Widely adored Marvel Studios president Kevin Feige has really changed the definition of what a comic book movie is. Lily Annalick, looking back on Andy Warhol and It Girl Edie Sedgwick for Edie in Andyland, contributing editor Lily Annalick relished the 60s spirit surrounding the iconic duo. The photos of Andy and Edie are more than 50 years old. The era they depict, seemingly so bygone and ephemeral, she says, and yet what could be more culturally relevant? Annalick's book on Eve Babbitt's Hollywood Nude will be published by Scribner in the fall. Rebecca Keegan, in Hollywood's New Classics, VanityFair.com, Hollywood correspondent Rebecca Keegan got to know two directors whose sensational success signals a changing of the white male-dominated old guard. Greta Gerwig, Oscar hopeful director of Lady Bird, and Jordan Peele, whose Get Out laid bare the inner workings of American racism. Despite their extraordinary talent, says Keegan, not long ago they wouldn't have gotten the opportunities to make the movies they've made. Hollywood is finally starting to ask, who's really getting the opportunities in this town, and who isn't? Here's the editor's letter from Graydon Carter. Stockholm Syndrome. A few months ago, a loopy meme that careened around the dark regions of the Internet speculated that a photograph taken on the south lawn of the White House proves that Melania Trump had been replaced by a body double. If only it had been referring to her husband. This conspiracy theory, like so many, was, of course, nuts. We actually do have a real First Lady. She's the one who has adopted her own version of blue steel, that steely, slit-eyed, purse-lipped set of the face. You may have noticed that her husband has also appropriated the look, in order, no doubt, to show that he is a man of parts. Trump didn't have that look when he was younger, and I suspect that he was inspired by watching Pierce Brosnan as James Bond, or Ben Stiller as Derek Zoolander. I'm sure it took the poor fellow months of practice in front of the mirror to get it right. Melania has also copied his signature, as we saw recently when she signed a guest book in South Korea right after the president did. Melania now writes her name using a signature that is a virtual copy of her husband's, the one that looks like a polygraph as drawn by a small field animal. This all may be evidence of Stockholm Syndrome, slowly taking on the characteristics of your captors, regardless of their awfulness. It can happen to entire countries, too. If you've ever visited the White House as a tourist, then you are familiar with the routine. You line up politely in the early morning hours outside the executive mansion, and eventually you are admitted through glass doors and security into the East Wing. Walking along the ground floor hallway toward the public rooms, you're probably not aware that you're passing the office of the military attaché who carry the football, the briefcase that holds the nuclear codes. You may also not be aware that you're walking above a secure bunker, the one Vice President Dick Cheney scurried to on 9/11. The East Wing, as you are told, is usually the province of the First Lady, and during this weepingly long first year of the Trump administration, it remains one of the most mysterious precincts in Washington. The West Wing has its fragrant mysteries, too. It's where much of the window-breaking, eye-scratching, and bloodletting occurs, even as Sarah Huckabee Sanders urges us to pay no attention to the men raging behind the curtain. The East Wing, by comparison, is today something of a black hole. Melania Trump is a largely unknown presence, rarely venturing out in public, and mainly seen walking alongside, or more often behind, her husband, occasionally swatting his tiny hand away when he tries to hold hers. When she speaks in public, her remarks have been scripted by others, and are grimly anodyne, like a hostage's statement of admiration for the mission of the kidnappers. The office of the First Lady currently has only about half the staff it did in previous administrations. Laura Bush was passionate about literacy. Michelle Obama was passionate about childhood obesity and healthy eating. It seemed like every time you looked around, she was gardening on the South Lawn with schoolchildren. Hillary Clinton was passionate, well, coldly calculating but relentless, about anything you happened to mention. Melania Trump, though, does not seem committed to any cause. She mentions cyberbullying from time to time, but no anti-cyberbullying effort has taken hold, and the epic irony of her choosing this as her passion is too ripe to ignore. We'd all be grateful if Melania could just persuade that squinty fellow walking in front of her to cease his bullying tweets, but it's not clear how much time she spends in his vicinity. As Sarah Ellison reports, in FLOTUS position, First Lady is not a role that Melania Trump sought or believed would ever be thrust upon her. Ellison quotes a longtime friend of the Trump family's, "She didn't want this come hell or high water." That said, she may have inadvertently precipitated her unhappy fate by telling the two-handed water drinker a few feet ahead to stop dithering about politics and just make up his mind. As Ellison points out, Melania is an unusual first lady and has already set some records. She is the only one to have been raised in a communist country. She is the only first lady to delay moving with her husband to the White House, in her case, until 5 months after the inauguration. She is the only one to be the third wife of a president, and the only one to have ever posed nude for published photographs. She is protective of her son, Barron, the youngest of the Trump children, now at school outside Washington. Questions swirl around the state of the Trump marriage, as they have for years. At the heart of it all is the cipher that is Melania, and an East Wing operation that seems to have very little to do. Until he moved into the White House in January, Donald Trump made his home in a shiny glass tower in Midtown Manhattan. Back in the 80s, Trump Tower, as it was so modestly named, was one of New York's better-known luxury buildings. It had a showy marble atrium for retail tenants, Central Park views in many of the apartments, and in-house maids for residents. Trump himself has long occupied the top floor in a triplex apartment with a color scheme in various shades of gold and King Tut Revival furnishings. Even though the building is only 58 stories high, his penthouse somehow sits on the 66th floor, a mathematical metaphor that could apply to so much of his presidency. As contributing editor Susanna Andrews explains in Faulty Tower, Trump's flagship building, which opened in 1983, has lost its former luster. It no longer ranks anywhere near the top of sought-after Midtown addresses and is now actively struggling to stay occupied. Sales and rentals of apartments have come almost to a standstill, and since Trump's election, at least 14 units have been put up for sale, with prices dropping to pathetic lows. Andrews investigates the unprecedented issues at the 725 Fifth Avenue property. At one time, celebrity tenants included Michael Jackson, Liberace, and Andrew Lloyd Webber. The current tenants are more along the lines of Paul Manafort, Russian money launderers, and various ex-cons. The Pentagon is a tenant. It pays $130,000 a month for a place to keep the nuclear football. The Secret Service, required by law to keep a team at the president's residence, traded offices in the skyscraper, for which the Trump Organization was reportedly asking too much in rent, for a temporary structure out on the sidewalk. Nothing says not forever, like a trailer. From Julie Miller comes In the Details. What You Should Know About Carrie Coon, a panoply of eccentric biographical data, re the Midwestern MVP. Photographs by Gaspar Tringale. Since Carrie Coon's Tony-nominated Broadway breakthrough 5 years ago as Honey in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the Ohio-bred actress has anchored two prestige television dramas, playing no-nonsense police chief Gloria Burgle on the latest iteration of FX's Fargo, and wrenching hearts as Nora Durst, a grief-hardened mother on HBO's dystopian epic The Leftovers. Given her bravura performances, Fargo netted her an Emmy nomination this year, in the same category as Nicole Kidman and Jessica Lange. It is not surprising that she was recruited by Steven Spielberg to co-star opposite Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks in The Post, the upcoming film about the Washington Post's role in exposing the classified Pentagon Papers in 1971. Coon plays reporter Meg Greenfield, with Streep as publisher Kay Graham and Hanks as editor Ben Bradley. It is surprising, though, that the 36-year-old Coon, who is married to Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and Tony-winning actor Tracy Letts, has so far refused to leave her Chicago home for the more industry-friendly hubs of Los Angeles and New York. Ahead, the biographical makeup of Carrie Coon, Midwestern jewel among movie stars. She grew up on 5 acres of farmland in Copley, Ohio, a small town west of Akron where her father's Alsatian family has lived since the 1800s. Her mother, Paula, an emergency room nurse, and her father, John, a janitor at an art museum, grew up on the same street and have been married 38 years. They live about a mile away from Coon's paternal grandparents, who have been married 70 years. The third eldest of 5 children, Coon has 3 biological brothers and 1 sister who was adopted from El Salvador. She discovered sports, soccer and track, long before acting. In fact, she auditioned for her first play, her high school's production of Our Town, on a whim, while waiting for soccer practice. She got the lead. The athlete does some of her own stunts, intentionally, like hurling herself down a hill on The Leftovers, or accidentally, like falling off a ladder and face-planting in full period costume during a performance of George Bernard Shaw's Miss Alliance in Spring Green, Wisconsin. The audience was stunned, but Coon's family wasn't. Her occasional inelegance long ago earned her the nickname Messy Bessie. She fell again in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but for co-star Letts, who played George, their showmance bloomed as the production traveled from Chicago to Washington, D.C. to Broadway. Letts won a Tony for his performance, but it was Coon's surprising nomination that sent Letts, 15 years her elder, into ecstatic fits of fist-pumping. "It was so unanticipated," Coon says. "I had started the play in Chicago, and nobody ever gets famous in Chicago. My life at that time was such a fairy tale." Their courthouse wedding plan, months later, was foiled when Letts underwent emergency gallbladder surgery. Rather than postpone, Letts and Coon simply changed venues. They wed in the Northwestern Memorial Hospital room where Letts was recovering. The bride wore leggings and a T-shirt. The groom wore a hospital gown and painkiller haze. While cleaning her closet a year later, Coon nearly disposed of a worn red T-shirt until Letts reminded her it was her wedding gown. They live in the Bucktown neighborhood of Chicago, in a 3-story modern home Letts purchased after the success of his play August, Osage County. The couple daydreams about life outside of Chicago. "We contemplate, if we were to have kids, could we raise them in New York City? That feels like a crazy question, but I was barefoot until I was 15. Incredibly, she didn't set foot in Los Angeles until she was 33, when summoned by director David Fincher for Gone Girl callbacks. Unable to afford lodging, Kuhn stayed with friends and their lovely but boisterous children until Letts surprised her on audition eve with a hotel room. She got the part, playing Ben Affleck's on-screen sister, and remembers the night of silence and solitude as being one of the best gifts she's ever received. Despite her impressive resume, Kuhn still drives a 2015 gray Toyota Camry and thinks in terms of sweat-wicking cotton rather than couture. To have more than one pair of tennis shoes or one sports bra still feels like an extravagance. Though she's astonished by her glowing reviews and recognition, the feedback she considers most meaningful comes from Copley, Ohio, not Hollywood. When my mom and dad call after seeing me in something and say, "I really forgot that was you," that's the best compliment I could ever get, because they brought me into the world and know me better than anyone. This Vanity Fair profile is by Krista Smith, with photograph by Boo George, Lily James, age 28, provenance London, role model. My grandmother Helen Horton was an actress. I looked up to her in every way. Upstairs, downstairs. After graduating from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, James brought mischief to the manor born as Lady Rose on Downton Abbey. Being cast was life-altering. We were like a family, and it was as good as it looked. Full tank. Since then, she's played Cinderella for Disney, Shakespeare's Juliet on stage for Kenneth Branagh, and an American waitress Deborah for Edgar Wright's Baby Driver. I was ready to break loose of the mold and try something different. War Room. This holiday season, in Darkest Hour, Joe Wright's World War II biopic, James stars as Elizabeth Layton, the secretary to Winston Churchill, played by Gary Oldman. I read her book, and it was endlessly fascinating hearing about Churchill's quirks and their relationship. As for working with Oldman, I've only met Gary out of costume a handful of times. It's awe-inspiring how he transforms as an actor. It took my breath away. Dancing Queen. This summer, in the sequel Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, she'll share a role with Meryl Streep, singing the part of Donna during her early years. There's no cynicism. It's all joy. You can't help but be completely drawn in and dance like a lunatic. Thank you. And for a photo, mountain high, the alpine town of Aspen, Colorado has long been a snowy playground for the jet-set crowd and a mecca for artists, intellectuals, and entrepreneurs. The natural beauty, high culture, and lofty luxury of this former mining camp are captured in a new book by longtime resident Aaron Lauder, Aspen Style, published by Asseline, is out now. And on to Sloan Crosley's Hot Type column. In a photo, Badlands National Monument, South Dakota, July 14, 1973, from Stephen Shore, Museum of Modern Art, is the publisher, by Quentin Bejac. You probably miss Jenny Diski, even if you've never heard of her. The beloved British author chronicled her terminal illness for the London Review of Books, and now The Vanishing Princess, published by Echo, a collection of her caustically funny and ebullient stories, is being released. Here are narratives that play with perception, turning fairy tales on their sides, if not their heads. Stories about women attempting to construct ideal bathtubs, contentedly existing in towers, and dipping in and out of mental institutions. Diski's is the kind of voice of which we need more, of which we now have one fewer. But she has paved a subversive path through the forest for others to follow. Is an axe man at large in New Orleans? So ask a 1918 Times-Picayune article in Nathaniel Rich's sprawling but speedy third novel, King Zeno, published by MCD. Set against the backdrop of the birth of jazz and the Spanish flu, King Zeno tells the story of an army veteran, a jazz cornetist, and a mafia widow, whose trajectories are twisted by a musically motivated axe murderer. It is a rich contemporary canonization of the Crescent City at the turn of the century. In the hierarchy of traumatic memoir, Maud Julian has something to write home about. She just has nowhere to address it. The Only Girl in the World, published by Little Brown, is the haunting story of a girl whose survivalist parents locked her away and subjected her to training starting at the age of 3. But it is also proof that love is in our nature regardless of our nurture. Order up. Eggs get no benediction in Brendan Francis Noonan and Rico Galliano's Brunch is Hell, published by Little Brown, an ode to dinner parties. And Galt Niederhofer Laces a Lover with Poison, published by St. Martin's. In short, Quantum Lit, Daniel Ellsberg's The Doomsday Machine, published by Bloomsbury, unpacks the power of our atomic arsenal. David N. Schwartz, fission's nuclear pioneer Enrico Fermi, The Last Man Who Knew Everything, published by Basic Books. VR meets IRI in Jaron Lanier's Dawn of the New Everything, published by Henry Holt. If the suit fits, read it in John Robin Bates's play Vicuña, published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Neil Mukherjee invents his own India in A State of Freedom, published by Norton. Jan Morris brings Japan's battleship Yamato, published by Livewright, to the surface. Literature gets the J.M. Ketsey treatment in Late Essays, published by Viking. Benjamin Taylor collects Susan Sontag's stories in Debriefing, published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Fiona Mosley's Forest is Foreboding, in Elmet, published by Algonquin. Vanity Fair editor-at-large Cullen Murphy journeys to Cartoon County, published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. George Wayne, Ask 'Em All, in Anyone Who's Anyone, published by Harper. Karen Duffy Straightens Her Backbone, published by Arcade. Mark K. Updegrove's The Last Republicans, published by Harper, explores the two President Bushes. Liz Josephsberg scales back with Target 100, published by Ben Bella. New York Magazine celebrates 50 years with Highbrow, Lowbrow, Brilliant, Despicable, published by Simon & Schuster. And Julia Vitale gives us this, The Lookers, photographs by Malik Sidibe, harness the energy of Bamako's 1960s and 70s youth scene in Mali Twist, published by Edition Xavier Barral. Katie Somerville, Lydia Kametsis, and Danielle Whitfield stitch 70 years of couture from the House of Dior, published by National Gallery of Victoria. Famous faces peer out from Dwayne Michaels' portraits, published by Thames and Hudson. Henri Jean Servat and Pierre Passebon share their obsession, Marlene Dietrich, published by Flammarion. Paul Duncan goes behind the scenes with David Bowie, The Man Who Fell to Earth, published by Taskin. Fancy Kicks get their due in Sneakers, published by Razorbill, by Rodrigo Corral. Andrew Nahum, Speed Test Ferrari, published by Phaedon. You can't turn back the clock, but you can look ahead in style with the Cartier Tank Watch, published by Flammarion, by Franco Cologni. Coffee tables rejoice. Stand-up guy. As Judd Apatow returns to his roots in a new Netflix special, a fellow comedian explores the wit and wisdom behind Apatow's act, by Mike Birbiglia. In the spring of 2014, I was having dinner with Judd Apatow at an Italian restaurant around the corner from the Comedy Cellar in New York, and he was telling me about this movie, Trainwreck, that he was about to direct, in which he would cast me, and he said, the good thing is, I'll be in New York, so I can do stand-up every night after the shoot. And I thought, I don't think he understands how stand-up works. In fairness to Judd, he did understand how it worked. As a high school student in 1980s Long Island, he would make cold calls and get well-known comedians like Gary Shandling and Jerry Seinfeld to appear on his school's radio station. By the time he was 19, he was doing stand-up himself, and shortly after that, appeared on HBO's Young Comedians special. But Judd wasn't content enough with his act to stay personally invested in the art of stand-up. Surrounded by friends like Adam Sandler and Jim Carrey, who would become megastars in front of the camera, Judd abandoned the stage and veered into writing for shows like The Ben Stiller Show and The Larry Sanders Show. 25 years later, he's the most recognizable comedy brand in Hollywood. So he should go back to stand-up again, right? Maybe not, but he did. And fortunately for comedy fans like me, the result is entirely personal, original, and hilarious. I've always thought that stand-up is a combination of creativity plus stage time. But watching Judd made me think it's a combination of creativity plus wisdom. And Judd has a lot of wisdom. Judd has a healthy marriage of 20 years. His children are grounded and self-possessed. I once asked Judd if he was raised with religion, and he said, "My mother didn't teach us religion, but she taught us to be kind." Judd's new special, The Return, on Netflix this month, explores that idea. How can you raise decent kids and have a good marriage in these strange modern times? He tells the story of a man struggling with that question, with a candor and wit that only the best comedians have. Should Judd Apatow have gone back to stand-up? Absolutely. Watch List by Richard Lawson. What to Go See? The Shape of Water. Who's in It? An Expressive Sally Hawkins, a Heartbreaking Richard Jenkins, and One Wet Sea Creature. We'll remind you of an old Hollywood romance with a lot more gore. Why now, this melancholy, transporting sci-fi swooner could finally be director Guillermo del Toro's Oscar win, when you can see it in theaters beginning December 8th. What to tune into, Last Tango in Halifax and Call the Midwife, Christmas specials. Who's in It? Some of the top actors working in British television. We'll remind you of reading a good cozy novel on a snowy evening. Why Now? Two of Britain's best series, one about finding love late in life, the other about nurses in post-World War II East London, go long for their annual extended holiday episodes. When you can see it, Halifax begins December 17th, Midwife on Christmas Day on PBS. What to Stream? Wormwood, Who's in It? Peter Sarsgaard, Molly Parker et al. Lend performances to a Talking Head documentary. We'll remind you of the recent spate of true crime series with a more abstract bent. Why Now? Acclaimed documentarian Errol Morris blends scripted scenes with interviews to explore a knotty, maddening murder conspiracy theory. When you can see it on Netflix beginning December 15th. Onto the fairground, around the world, one party at a time. Rock of Middle Ages, photographed by Hannah Thompson. A suitably bejeweled crowd converged on the Met Cloisters, the Metropolitan Museum of Art's uptown Manhattan outpost for medieval European art and architecture, for a dinner to celebrate Bulgari's newly redesigned New York flagship store on Fifth Avenue. Guests were seated in the covered passageways surrounding the cloister, an open-air courtyard that also served as the stage for a performance by dancer Lil Buck. After dinner, they congregated in the 12th century Fuente Dueña Chapel, where Demi Lovato closed the night with an acoustic set. In this photo, Lily Aldridge and John Cortajarena. Power moves. Birds fly south. The powers that be execute geographic pivots. So it was with the 4th annual Vanity Fair New Establishment Summit, held for the first time outside of the Bay Area in Los Angeles, over 2 days in October, all manner of makers of films, buildings, billion-dollar apps convened at the Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts for a State of the Union of Art and Commerce in the Digital Age. In the photos, Kara Swisher, Gabriel Sherman, and Nick Bilton, Randall Stevenson and Richard Plepler, David Zaslav, David Steinberg, and Robin Todd Steinberg, Donna Langley, Jason Bloom, and Patty Jenkins, Kevin Seastrom, Brian Grazer and Paul Allen, Larry David and Graydon Carter, Shonda Rhimes, John Carey and Bill McGlasson, Preet Bharara and Sally Yates, Chris Bosch, Maureen Dowd, Jonathan Nolan, and Reid Hoffman. Jeffrey Blackburn and Mark Cuban, Satya Nadella, Bob Iger, and Ted Sarandos, Ava DuVernay. After the first day's program, speakers and attendees met at Bouchon for cocktails. David Ajay, Angelica Houston, and Michael Govan, Judd Apatow, Evan Spiegel, Walter Isaacson, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. And in more photos from Rock of Middle Ages, Jill Biden and Ashley Biden, Demi Lovato, Ines van Lemsweerd and Vinod Matadin, Lil Buck, Jean-Christophe Babin, Laura Harrier and Michael Carl, Josephine Scriver, Misty Copeland, Nicola Bulgari, Flaviano Matata, and Ciara. Dress You Up, Vanity Fair, and Saks Fifth Avenue saluted the 2017 International Best Dressed list with cocktails at the Academy Mansion in New York. Photographs by Hannah Thompson. In the photos, Petra Collins and Selah Marley, Marjorie Gubelman and Jessica Diehl, Rinaldo Herrera, Amy Bell, and Amy Fine Collins, Mark Metrick, Rupal Patel, Chris Mitchell, and Tracy Margulies, Princess Alexandra of Greece and Jonathan Becker, an Instagrammable feast conjured by Lingerie Soho, Carolina Herrera, Daphne Guinness, Kelly Rutherford, and Malin Ackerman, Fran Lebowitz, and Lisa Robinson. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections from the CD Celtic Harp Christmas.